Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Kellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here as usual, and we also have with us this episode Spencer.
Hi, everyone. Tonight we're going to be re-recording an episode that we did a long time ago, never got it edited out. A lot of you might remember back in like the month or two leading up to the release of The Gathering Storm, we tried to do a recap of Knife of Dreams, and we did okay. I think we got up to like chapter 17 actually posted. We actually have most of the rest of the episodes. In fact, you should have heard one or two of them before this episode gets posted. So, and this is the only one we have to re-record, which, considering all the technical crap that we've been going through in the last couple months, is an absolute miracle.
I have to agree with that. I've had two computer hard drives die and my laptop get stolen, and that has not been a lot of fun.
I bet not. Because we want to get through these as quickly as possible, honestly, I think, 5 chapters we have to go over tonight. We really don't want these episodes to run 2 or 3 hours long. Sometimes we like having those for a recap like these. I'm not sure that we want it to be as long as for... So we're going to try and get through these... we're going to try and get through these quickly, so we're going to jump right into them. First off, our customary spoiler warning... We have read through all the books of The Wheel of Time, and we're going to talk about all of them, even though we're just doing a recap on Knife of Dreams. This is going to be tricky, because for the rest of the recaps, we hadn't read Gathering Storm. We have now. And so as much as we might think that we don't want to, we're going to be making references to Gathering Storm as well, I think. So just realize that.
We'll be
as careful as possible, but... But we have read all the books, and we have the knowledge of what happens in all of them, and we're going to be talking about them all. So if you haven't read all the way through The Gathering Storm, then you might want to turn off the podcast now and come back to it later when you have.
Well, I'm going to be talking about The Towers of Midnight, too, so I don't know about the rest of you guys. Just kidding.
And I'm going to spoil every work ever written by Brandon Sanderson.
I've already done that. Thank you.
Sorry, couldn't resist. Well, I probably could have, but I didn't.
Well, I'm still smarting from the one I did, so don't even go there. We are going to start out with chapter 23, which is entitled A Call to a Sitting. We start out with Ramonda Kassin's point of view. Ramonda is in the tent that she shares with Magla and Salida, reading about Brigitte and Gaidol Kane in The Flame, the Blade, and the Heart. The weaves of keeping that Egwene discovered are now failing. Bodwin Coffin straightens the tent for the other two. Ramonda shares her tent with the other two sitters in order to keep an eye on the other two sitters for the Yellow Aja. Ramonda thinks that they follow her lead far too seldom. Magla insists on Salida as the new sitter for the Yellow, but Ramonda does not understand why. She wanted Dagdara, but gave in so that she would be elected First Weaver, her position before she retired. Nisau enters, leaving Saren Hogain, her warder, outside to stand guard, and Ramonda sends Bodwin to her classes. It is noted that Verilyn still leads the daily negotiations with Elida's assembly in Darain with Magla, Soroya, Takima, and Faisal. Nisau wards against eavesdropping and then asks Ramonda to intercede with Lelaine. Lelaine ordered her to stop inquiring into the murders of Anaya and Kyren, as she was doing under Egwene's command. Ramonda is only now realizing Egwene's strength of leadership, and she agrees to intercede. All that Nisau learned so far was that they were both close friends with Cabriana Macandes. Theoden arrives as Nissau leaves. Ramonda took her in because the Brown Aja did not really support her. She announces that Lelaine has called a sitting of the hall. Ramonda heads to the hall alone as she has no warder. She sees Gareth Bryn escorting Siwan to the Blue Aja area of the camp. She hears a gong that signifies change of classes for the novices. The novice Sharina Malloy has reorganized the entire novice structure without even asking Tiana, who is the mistress of novices. Ahead, she sees Sharina talking to Tiana. As Ramonda approaches, Sharina curtsies and leaves. Tiana tells her that Sharina and many others, including the Mirandian noble, are learning Nynaeve's new healing methods. Ramonda is appalled that novices are allowed to learn healing, normally reserved only for Aes Sedai, but Tiana defends herself in her decision. Ramonda sees Delana heading in the same direction with Halima, lecturing her. She thinks that they are pillow friends. Fortunately for Ramonda, the new style of healing is different enough so that it's not subject to the second learned weave limitation. Ramonda arrives at the hall pavilion where a crowd is already gathered. Sheriam is there already. It is embarrassing as the keeper is only allowed in the hall if the Amarlin is present. Malind and Faisel discuss how they finally coerced Morel into bonding Liu. After Ramonda seats herself, Quamiso arrives, then Salida, followed by Lorel, Soroya, Aledrin, Samalin, Faisel, Valind, Escalade, and Verilin is still in Dorane, but they have still more than 11, so they may begin. Aledrin makes the meeting private so that they will not be eavesdropped upon. At Lelaine's request, Moria goes across the street to the Blue Aja quarters and returns with Maurice Hyandel, Jahar Narishma, and her other two warders. The sitters recognize him as an Ashaman. Malind rushes away. Maurice announces that the Dragon Reborn asks Cadswain to send her. Jahar asks for Egwene, and Ramonda says that she is unavailable. Jahar suddenly becomes furious, claiming that a man just tried to listen in. Aledrin agrees that something touched her ward. Delana gets up and runs. Malind returns with Nacelle of the Green Aja. She weaves all five powers around Jahar, something akin to detecting residues, and she excitedly announces that he is holding Sidene. On request, he channels spirit towards Soroya, and Nacelle is able to detect it. With this new advantage tested, Nacelle leaves. Jahar announces that any sister faithful to Egwene Alvera may bond an Ashaman soldier or dedicated to a total of 47. 47 balances the number of sisters bonded by the Ashaman. Ramonda likes the idea, but Faisel and Soroya are adamantly opposed. Jahar announces that the taint is gone, and Maurice confirms his claim. All but Faisel and Soroya vote to accept the offer, so they have the lesser consensus. Jahar explains that Elida sent them against the Black Tower so that Taim ordered them captured and bonded. That would be the sisters that the Ashaman have bonded. The number is augmented because four Ashaman have already been bonded as warders by Aes Sedai. He then tells them of a fifth, Eben Hopwell, who was killed by a female Forsaken channeling Sidene while they were linked with Daigian and Beldine. He died defending his Aes Sedai. Escalda offers her sympathies. Ramonda remembers where she heard of Cabrion and Macondes and announces that they must order the arrest of Delana and Halima immediately. But they are already gone, last seen with Delana's serving woman carrying bundles toward the traveling ground. Kind of an interesting chapter. I've always liked that scene with Jahar facing down all the Aes Sedai. He really stands up for himself there. You know, he gets himself out from under Maurice's thumb a little bit. You know, it's kind of cool, really.
I will always like Jahar Narishma. I love Narishma, honestly. There's a short list of... it's kind of a short list of who I would love the opportunity to play in a Watt movie. Of course, it's headed by Gawain, but Jahar Narishma he's definitely on the list.
He's a pretty cool character, I think, and then there is that sort of tantalizing comment that he's the one who comes after, you know, wielding Kalendor.
A lot of this is also just sort of set up. I mean, where Robert Jordan really enjoyed his, you know, bringing symmetry in this. And in the scene, they're trying to develop this symmetry, not truly realizing that the Aes Sedai and the White Tower under Elida are doing the exact same thing right now. I mean, they've already sent, you know, a group off, and of course now there's, you know, all sorts of confusion back and forth with Aes Sedai bonding or Ashimon and Ashimon bonding Aes Sedai. And, you know, it's an interesting thing because we're working towards a type of order, but at the same time, the characters are generating more and more chaos. And I'm trying to think where I'm actually going with this. Just the entire, you can tell that the whole world is moving toward Ptarmigan. And this keeps in again, this chapter brings up the too young sitter theory, which is a mystery that does not get resolved until Gathering Storm. And it's just one of those weird things that no one really knows what's going on. Cabriana gets brought up again, and they've, it's very obvious by this point that Cabriana was a direct threat to Arangar posing as Halima, and that is why there, all these different eliminations have taken place, is to cover up the secrets so that Halima's hiding place will not be disclosed. But of course, in the same chapter we get we get Nerishma coming in and totally spoiling it anyway. So yeah. A lot goes on for a relatively simple chapter, really.
Yeah. Some of you, of course, will probably remember that Cabriana was the one Aes Sedai that was captured and interrogated by Semirag along with her warder, and she and the warder both ended up dying under the interrogation because Semirag was somewhat distracted. And Cabriana and... hold on a second, my brain went dead here. Anaya, Kyren, and Cabriana were known as the three. They were so close when they were all in one place together, so there was obviously some concern there. And yes, I think it's very interesting that we saw Halima get, and Delana, basically it was Black Aja, become revealed, and it was Romanda that figured it out. I thought that was kind of cool. Too little too late, but there you go.
Exactly. And I mean, I'm sure that's going to arise at some other point later in the series to kind of come back and bite people, probably when at least when it is least expected.
Yeah.
So, moving on, next is chapter 24, Honey and the Tea. Egwene meets the Saladar Aes Sedai sitters in Teller Anriad and reaffirms her orders that she wants no attempt at a rescue. She begins her first morning in the White Tower with another spanking from Sylveana. Avienda had previously attempted to teach her to embrace the pain of the Aiel Du, and she attempts to use it to tolerate her punishments. Malare has confirmed Leanne's identity. As she leaves, as Egwene leaves the Mistress of Novices study, she sees Alvierin waiting for her turn with Sylveana. Two Red Sisters escort her to her room and then to the dining hall for breakfast. There she sees Nicola, another novice, Alvister, intentionally trips Egwene, but Egwene puts her in her place, with some very authoritative lecturing. Laris is, of course, seen in the kitchens during this particular chapter. She helped Sawan and Leanne escape, but Egwene decides that she's not going to approach Leanne because she kind of assumes that... Not Leanne. But she's not going. Decides not to approach Laris because she pretty much assumes that Laris only helped Sawan and Leanne for the fact that they were connected to men, and she had taken a liking to men. After breakfast, two more Red Sisters, Caterin and Jezreel, wait for her with more fork root tea. They then take her to her first novice class, and she thoroughly embarrasses Idril Menford by making elaborate weaves against the accepted's orders, with, you know, barely any use of the one power at all due to the fork root. The display includes 14 colored balls and circles of air and fire, all interweaving with each other in an intricate pattern. Catrin and Jezreel send her to Sylviana again, and after two more classes with accepted, it is decided that Egwene can only have private lessons from Aes Sedai. All the Aes Sedai, even sitters, seem distracted to Egwene's reckoning. Pavara and Dosin almost run into her. She wants to find the ferrets that Sherium and the others have sent. The second night, she goes to visit Leanne. Felana and Dalvian stand guard with with one warder. Leanne has had many visitors at this point wanting to learn new weaves from her, and Malara and Asala have given Leanne a beating. That afternoon, Brienne Nalsad lectures on Shan Chula and the Third War of Garen's Wall and the Great Winter War between Andor and Kyrian, and the Welican Rebellion. Egwene shocks her with secret information on Shane, which is courtesy of the lectures someone had given on the contents of the 13th Depository in the library, as well as six previous rebellions within the White Tower. Later that day, Lorraine Dorilan makes it clear that she thinks Elida made mistakes, and Egwene discusses Shemarin's demotion with Pratale. After a frustrating session, as Lorna Bastien says she thinks even Kutswani would have had a challenge with Egwene. Egwene's punishments are intensified because she is embracing them, and that day, Egwene has to receive healing twice. On her second day, Egwene discovers... I totally scrolled down and lost my place. On the second day, Egwene discovers that Arina is working in the stables. She and Nicola are very close. They tell the novices tales of Egwene, making her a legend like Virgit or Amaresu. Some try to emulate Egwene, but Sylviana quickly sets them straight by the fourth day. Egwene becomes a kind of mentor to the novices, such as Mara and Nemain and Caride. Ghosts are appearing within the White Tower, signifying the approach of Tarmogoyf Gaiden, and it has everybody scared. Padara and her novice class lose their room to shifting of walls. There are 103 novices and 31 accepted currently within the White Tower. Accepted, such as Mare and Aesil, tried to give her orders, but of course Egwene refuses to obey. She's shocked at confirmation that sisters have sworn fealty to Rand and that the Ashaman have bonded sisters to them. On the morning of her second day, Alvieran offers to help her escape, but Egwene declines. On the fourth day, she runs into Matin Stafanos, escorted by Cariande and Nisita. He thinks Elida saved him because Rand murdered the other nobles. Egwene tells him that Raven killed Morghese, that Kolvare has hung herself, and Rand supports Elaine for the Lion Throne and the Sun Throne. He appointed a High Lord as a steward in Tyr. Matin Stafanos looks thoughtful at what Egwene has told him. On her seventh day, Egwene has a lesson, and she runs into Nilvere, Somalin, and Bayonin with their warders. Egwene angrily accuses Bayonin of betraying her and being Black Aja. Miliver is infuriated, but Bayonin asks to talk with Egwene alone. Bayonin claims that she betrayed nothing. Her oath no longer holds since Egwene was captured. Egwene asks her what all she betrayed. Bayonin starts to deny the betrayal, but chokes. Egwene interprets this to mean that she is not Black Aja, but she betrayed the moles at the very least. Bannon admits that Elida is having them watched. Egwene orders Bannon to warn them. Bannon claims that she has already warned Madiani and Jeanette, but it is too risky to talk to the other Ajahs. Egwene then orders her to do it as a penance, and Bannon reluctantly agrees. She says that she wants to bring Elida down. At one point, Egwene notes that she has not had headaches or bad dreams since she has been captured. She has had fine dreams about Rand, Matt, Perrin, and Gawain. That evening, she goes to visit with Leanne, where three white Aj sisters, Nagora, Noreen, and Niasi, stand guard. She tells Leanne about Bannon. Other sisters still quiz Leanne about new weaves, so they interpret that to mean Bannon did not betray everything. The morning of her ninth day, Dosine heals Egwene. Then she goes for her morning spanking with Sylviana. She engages Sylviana in a conversation about Shemarin. Egwene goes down to breakfast, and all the novices stand when she enters. Aishlin runs to get her tray. She sips her tea, and there is honey in it. Added everything together, Egwene feels that she is winning her war.
Well, I think the first thing that jumped out to me was the fact that I was surprised that Egwene didn't make more of the connection to being captured and out away from, well, for one thing, we know Halima, to the headaches disappearing. That seemed extraordinarily dense to me that she didn't catch that connection, but at least she's noticed it. I personally think that those weaves are going to come back to haunt us. If nothing else, I think it might have opened Egwene up to the possibility of someone having an easier time of doing compulsion or other, you know, evil doer sort of weaves on her. Now, who is left to do that with the Purge? Never mind. That's a great Gathering Storm spoiler. But I think that will come back to haunt us. That's the only thing I worry about. Seems like a lot of effort for Halima to have gone to and, you know, basically a Forsaken, a recycled Forsaken, you know, had to have something more in mind than just making Egwene's life miserable with headaches. You know, there had to be something else going on there. She never actually did compel her to do anything that we know of. But, and if she was just leading up to that, then that sure took a long time, considering that, you know, Mogedion and Robin and everything to basically make somebody do something on the first go-round. Maybe Halima wasn't as adept at that particular weave, but it seems to me that she was laying groundwork for some future, you know, coup de grace of some sort. And I worry that there may be something in the offing.
I hope I don't get offed.
Mm-hmm. Or you do. And then the other interesting thing to me in that chapter is Bannon gets caught right away, having betrayed everything, basically.
Well, there's that. I really liked any scene that we got where Egwene was being authoritative, particularly with the novices and the accepted. I was very happy to see that, you know, Egwene, one of the issues, and this will be the easiest way to explain what I'm thinking, one of the issues I've had with Nynaeve on occasion is she seems like one of those channelers who will use a hammer when a toothpick is necessary. And I mean, just like Nynaeve will heal stuff by just slamming massive amounts of the One Power into it. And for all that she's wonderful with her way of healing, what she's doing is literally just throwing everything she has at the situation. And here Egwene, you know, they're like, oh, make a flame. And Egwene's like, I can barely channel it all. Flame and rings and fire and balls flying around the room. And it's just like, and it's amazing. And, you know, it's like a scalpel. And You know, and it's just, I love that because it just shows how much Egwene thinks and how much, you know, how much she uses, you know, what she has available. And, you know, it keeps coming back. I say it in podcasts that were recorded later, and, you know, Egwene is just made of awesome.
Yeah, she totally is.
You know, and also then getting to see, you know, she handles the, oh, well, you know, I'm going to try to trip you thing with, you know, the modicum of grace that you can possibly, you know, attribute to it. And then they all turn around and start coming to her when they get scared. They don't go to the Mistress of Novices. You know, when they're concerned about something, they come and they talk to Egwene. And I just thought that was just amazing and awesome.
Yeah, well, Egwene's a class act. There's no question about it. Although, I do have to say, in Nynaeve's defense, Nynaeve learned to channel under different circumstances. She was a wilder who learned to channel, basically, and was lucky not to be one of the 3 out of 4 that die teaching themselves. And she had her block going on, and basically the only way she could ever learn to channel was to get mad enough to chew nails and spit iron, or chew iron and spit nails, however that works. And so I think that's why she has the, you know, massive hammer, or as she did in one of the earlier books, the, you know, the humongous long pryer made out of the power when Egwene's thin trickle of earth in the lock would break it. She just, the only way she knows is to just get herself mad enough where she just goes over the top and smash the problem. And I think that's going to carry through with her for her whole life.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Well, and honestly, if you kind of look at her way to healing, it's kind of like that, where, you know, for the rest of the Aes Sedai, well, we just need a little bit of spirit and some water and what is the other one, air or fire? I don't remember.
Yeah.
Whereas with her, she kind of goes over the top and she uses all 5 of them, but she gets much better results than what this crappy warside surgeon kind of healing that the Aes Sedai have been practicing for the last 100 or so years.
Thousands of years since the breaking, they lost a lot. There was something else that struck me in that little thing there, and I can't remember where I was going with it now. I know it's kind of an interesting, this isn't what I was thinking of, but I'm just going past it here. This is kind of an interesting scene with Mutt and Stephaneos, too. She handled that with great aplomb as well. Oh, I know what it was that I was thinking of. Has there been anybody besides possibly Matt, when he was in the last days of having the Shadar Logos dagger, is there anybody that has had as many healings as Egwene? You know, what if it's like, you know, sarcophagus in Stargate? If you get healed too many times, you lose part of your humanity or something? I mean,
maybe if you're healed through power.
I think we should go to the next chapter.
All right. Well, the next chapter is chapter 25, Attending Stupid Face Elida.
No, it does not say that.
Oh, yes, it does.
Attending Elida.
It says Attending Stupid Face Elida. I'm reading it right
face,
here.
But the chapter is entitled Attending
face.
Elida, chapter 25.
You read it however you want. I ain't going back and changing it. Attending Stupid Face Elida.
Wait a minute. I'm tempted to do a spoiler here. No, I'm not going to do it.
Oh, I so want to. Oh. Crap, what's her name now? No, anyway.
Don't say it. Don't do it. You'll be crushed.
Okay.
Destroyed.
All right. So we're going to go on to chapter 25.
I
want to
know if it ever going to stop the rain. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay.
I'll be good.
All right. So we're going to go on to chapter 25, Attending Stupid Face. I can't do it with a straight face.
Go ahead.
I had to stop laughing first. We're going to go on to chapter 25, Attending Elida. We start out with Tarna Fear's point of view. It's 9 days since Egwene was captured. Tarna climbs the stairs to Elida's quarters. She avoids the corridors where she might run into Sisters of Another Aja. She thinks on her way on Prevera's question from almost 2 weeks ago. Which Red Aja sisters can be trusted to bond Ashaman even with Tsutsama's blessing? She has only one name on her list, and it will not work. Elida and Midani are in the sitting room. They spend a lot of time together. Tarna announces that she has the morning reports, and Elida says Midani away. Elida confines that they were... Elida confides that they were once pillow friends and that she might allow it again in order to question her. That is rare outside novices and accepted, although Tarna recalls Galena making a pass at her. If you say so.
Ew.
Despite being a red, Tarna prefers the intimate comforts of men. Elida allows the Weave of Keeping to be shared widely, and it seems to be working. Tarna has no news on the other 9 moles. There is no news on locating the seals, and the harbors are blocked so that the city is starting to suffer. Elida orders sentences with Sylvana for any sitters who do not deliver enough workers to dismantle the chains. Tarna reports that Egwene spends half her days with Sylvana. It's Sylviana or Sylvana?
Sylviana.
Yeah. Then I've been saying it wrong, too bad.
Yeah.
Elida wants her tamed but not broken, so the White Tower will remain strong. Tarna believes that Egwene will come around soon, recalling that Galena beating her block out of her was much less intense than the beating that Sylviana is lashing upon Egwene. Elida wants Egwene to attend her tonight. Then we jump from the White Tower to wherever the heck it is that Matt is, because we're going to Matt's point of view. Oh, it's Matarin, apparently. Matt and his party leave Matarin and head to the forest as soon as they are out of sight of any farms. The dice start up again. Oh, goody. 2 days later, the group stops for a midday rest. They are 300 miles west of the Demona Mountains, and Matt wants to reach them in a week. Vanning claims to know a smuggler's pass. After lunch, Matt uses Aludra's strikers to light up a pipe. Tom and Aludra place stones. The Red Arms, including Metuin and Harnin, take care of the 60 pack horses that Luca purchased in Matarin. Leowen, Domon, Julian, and Amethyra are also nearby. Noel plays snakes and foxes with Ulver. The game reminds Matt of the Eelfin and maybe the Elfin being in his head. Jolene, Belric, and Fen, Bethamin, and Sita, Teslin, and Edesina are there, and Jolene and Edesina are now teaching both Bethamin and Sita. Matt thinks the golem is following Luca's circus. Luca is heading for Murundi as well. Matt refused healing after Matarin, and now his wounds are infected. A black lance wriggles out from under the log Julian and Amethyra are sitting on. Julian starts after it, but Matt tells him to let it go. For some reason, this is endearing to Tuon, and she lets Matt kiss her. Matt accepts his reward and is very good at what he does. She then sends Seleucia for ointments for his wounds. Riders approach, and Matt mounts Pips. They are Vannin and Telmanes. Telmanes tells Matt that Vannin updated him on Nessalion and the others. Matt is angry that Telmanes is in Altara instead of being with Egwene. Telmanes tells him Egwene really is the Amaryllis Seat, and they are off to besiege Tar Valon. It's a couple months late. They can travel like the Dragon Reborn. Matt sees the colors spin and resolve into Rand talking with an Aes Sedai with gray hair in her bun. Talmanes brought 3 banners of horse, 4,000 mounted crossbowmen, and the Masons. He left 3 banners of horse and 5 of foot in Murundi with orders to move north into Andor. King Roydaren paid them so they would have plenty of money. Matt introduces Talmanes to Tuon. Matt grabs his hat and Ashandari and orders Talmanes to take them back to the band. The Shanshan have camp scattered all over. There was a landslide, so the pass Fannin was planning to use is now blocked. The Demona Mountains were made during the breaking, so other passes are unlikely. They set out riding, and Matt starts to plan how to get out of Altara. And that's the end of that chapter. All right, so I think the first thing we want to take note of up here is that Tarna, as she's thinking about who to send, which Red Aja sisters to send to bond the Ashaman, she only has one name on her list, and that name will not work. This was not answered in Gathering Storm, so I think it's free to speculate openly. Who the heck do you think is on her list?
I don't know.
Because we know the final group is Pavara, Tarna, Jezreel, Dasala, Malare, and Javindra. That happens in the epilogue of Knife of Dreams. We see them. So
the only one I can think of that didn't end up going with him is Tutsama, and she wouldn't work because she's the highest.
Yeah.
Leader.
So it makes me wonder, though, if possibly the name on her list was Tarna herself, and mm-hmm. I can't leave. I'm the keeper. I have to be here to keep Elida in line from going absolutely postal on everything.
Well, I can't think that she would think of herself as only one name on the list that wouldn't work. I'm going to vote for Tutsama because she was the highest.
You think so?
You know, yeah, the head of the Red Aja. She couldn't leave. Although
well,
Galena
do you think
did.
That she's the only one that Tarna would put on a list of Reds capable of bonding Ashaman?
I don't know.
Andrew?
Not sure. And I've thought about this, and part of it is just that, I completely lost what I was going to say. I mean, I know I particularly don't have any ideas for anybody who hasn't already been mentioned. To me, the highest does make sense, just because it would be like, oh, well, we can't send yet another sister or sitter out of the tower. So let's, the qualifications for people who could, it seems to me that we haven't met enough of the Reds. I mean, we meet a number of them, and almost all of them are thoroughly okay or dislikable, one or the other. And as a result, that either immediately qualifies them or completely disqualifies them. So it's like, I don't really know.
Interesting.
Yeah. Also interesting in the first part of this chapter is how Tarna mentions that Galena was making passes at her. I don't know about you two, but I very much doubt that the end game there for Galena was just to get into Tarna's bed.
Probably not.
Seeing that she was whatever constitute. What's the name for the highest of the Black Aja? Because that's who Galena was before she butchered the Dumais Wells. The whole situation with that.
The highest. That's what they call her, Tutsama, or whatever her name was. She was.
No.
Replaced
yeah,
Galena.
She was on the red too. No, I was thinking Black Aja though. The leader of the Black Aja.
I don't know who. I don't know.
Well, let's find out if Encyclopedia Whatnot. By the way, the summaries that we're using are all. Oh, she's second in command. Excuse me. She's second in command of the Black Aja.
Oh, okay.
So, what's her face from the white sister who's actually black? Yeah, Alvi Arryn. Alvi Arryn's the leader, whatever her name is. But, yeah, so I got sidetracked on what I was saying. All the summaries that we're using for these are derived from the summaries that EncyclopediaWatt.org has on their website for the chapters for Knife of Dreams, and we want to definitely thank them for the work they do for that and for having that available for us.
Definitely. I couldn't do this without Encyclopedia Watt.
No. For each and every show, Encyclopedia Watt is an absolutely amazing resource. All right, so Tarna's interesting. Obviously, because she says Elida wants a queen to attend her tonight, we can kind of put this in the we can try and wrap our heads around where this fits in the timeline. We know that maybe I shouldn't. Never mind, I'm not going to. Well, let's just say Egwene doesn't attend Elida in this in Knife of Dreams. So we know that that has to happen eventually, because we can't imagine that Tarna would, who we see going into the Black Tower at the during the epilogue of Knife of Dreams, can't imagine that she would pack up and leave within hours of being told that of this meeting that she's having with Elida here. So, we know the books aren't written the way that the events actually happened chronologically in world. So it's kind of interesting, though, to actually see that and try and wrap your head around, okay, well, then this belongs here, which is in the middle of the next book or wherever it is.
Yeah, it gets a little confusing sometimes. Too many plot lines going on right now. Fortunately, we get some of them wrapped up eventually, but...
Yeah. Yeah, and Matt just trying to get away from it all, away from the madness that's following him out of Ibudar. I love how it says he kind of assumes that the golem is following Lucas Circus, that that's how it's tracking him, and we're it's much more likely that it's still somewhere behind Matt. So here's a question for you two. Do you think it's more likely that the golem is somehow tracking Matt, or that there's a dark friend in the... Well, it's almost assured that there's a dark friend among one of the persons in the group, but there's a dark friend in the group who is feeding information to the golem somehow.
Boy, that's scary, because we've known all the people around Matt for so long. It seems hard.
Here's the third option. Do you think that maybe there was a dark friend in Lucas Circus that was feeding information about Matt, and that dark friend no longer has information on Matt, besides he went off that direction?
I'm under the impression that Matt might not be the one who's being tracked himself. I think it might be possible that the golem is tracking Matt through the women who can channel around him.
Well, the women that can channel around him, or maybe he's tracking him through Noel, because we know that Jane Farstrider and the Dark One have a history.
This is true, too.
Yeah. Noel's the only one I could think of that would really be a hugely likely candidate to be a dark friend, but he may be an unwilling one at this point in time. But that doesn't mean that he can't be pumped for information.
Yeah. I guess there are just a lot of different possibilities on how this thing is tracking Matt.
I don't know if the golem can track Tavirin the way Ishamiel always claimed he could, but some of the Forsaken can definitely track Tavirin.
Yeah, that's true. It's very true.
And then the other thing that we're overlooking in some of these little scenes is that Tuon gets her first kiss from Matt.
Oh. Well, she actually gets two kisses. She gets one that's kind of soft and sweet, and then she's like, what, do you think I'm your sister?
What, am I your sister?
And then he actually kisses her, and she's like, woo! And then she goes all prim and proper. Oh, you need to get your wounds looked at.
Yeah.
Silly girl. Also, I think is interesting here is that the Band of the Red Hand has expanded so far beyond what it was when Matt left. I mean, he's got, what to say,
he brought more with him than the whole band was before, and he left almost
Talmanes brought three banners of horse, 4,000 mounted crossbowmen, and a banner of masons.
Yeah, that's a lot of dudes. And he left three banners of horse and five of foot in Mirandy.
Yeah.
The whole band wasn't that big when Matt left. Matt's
like,
how are we going to pay all these guys? Ah! Well, that's all right. We've been moonlighting on the side with King Rodrin of Mirandy. Oh,
yeah.
That's nice.
Matt, now you can invade any country you want and take over.
Yeah, really? That's a pretty darn sizable army, really, for those days.
Well, yeah. And especially since Rand has come along and kind of just shattered everything. There's no actual group that good size to
the Aiel.
Yeah. But, I think it's interesting here how we already kind of have things being laid down that Talmani sent the rest of the, you know, three banners of horse and five, what is it? Yeah, three banners of horse and five of foot. He sent them to Andor, and I think it's kind of interesting how, you know, we mentioned before in the podcast, in the Knife of Dreams read-throughs, how it's interesting how everything was converging on Eridomen. It's also interesting, though, to kind of see starting here the converging on Andor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's too much of a spoiler or not, but...
I don't know.
Because Eridomen. Mm, yeah, fun place. Grendel's hanging out.
I think another interesting thing here is that we see yet another example of the colors spinning around and resolving into one of the other Ta'veren and what they're doing right that minute. You know, I just think that seems to me that that's got to play some sort of pivotal role in the next couple of books. It's just too interesting not to. Some sort of a communication method. I mean, I have to agree with Jesse. I mean, just imagine, if you will, if everybody in the Wheel of Time had cell phones, how this book would change.
Or if Elaine just shared some of those communication Tarangriel that she has stashed away.
Yeah, well, don't get me started on that. I'm still fretting about that book Tarangriel. Probably has all of the knowledge of the Age of Legends and ages before that sitting there at her fingertips, and she's using it for a doorstop or something. Ugh.
It's not like it's going to grab her face and suddenly download all the knowledge of the ancients.
Well, no, but it's not going to grab her, but, you know, she could sit there and go through that and check out some books, you know? Not literally check them out, but examine some of the books that are... I mean, the thing is, from the Age of Legends, it's got books from the Age of Legends. Oh, my God. You know what one of the Brown would give for that? Viren would go berserk. Oh, my goodness. And Egwene's just letting it sit there. She's not even... They figured out how to use it. They figured out what it does. And it's just sitting there.
I think, unfortunately, though, you know how it has the fiction and nonfiction. I think even as cool as it would be to have all that knowledge, I'd still spend all my time in nonfiction.
Well...
And I said that wrong. Anyway.
In fiction. You'd spend all your time in fiction?
I'd spend all my time in fiction.
Well, that's
preferably
fine.
That's,
you know,
a good
what?
Fantasy from the Age of Legends.
She wants to know how to do all these weaves, how to create things from the Age of Legends, how to make Tarangriel and Angriel and Sa'angriel. It probably says so in there. There's probably a how-to. How to make Sa'angriel for dummies in that book. In that Tarangriel. Seriously, you think I'm joking? It's driving me crazy.
Fancloth weaving 101.
Yeah, anything.
Kalendor for dummies.
Yeah.
Or Quendiar.
Yeah, Egwene already figured out how to do Quendiar, so that's all right. But, you know.
The Tarangriel of the world and what they're used for.
Yeah. A compendium of all Tarangriel and what they go for on eBay, you know.
Well, maybe not all of them, just some of the cooler ones that the hall has now. Or whatever.
Yeah, Tarangriel and how to use them. Hmm.
So you want to make Tarangriel.
Yeah, exactly, I'm telling you. I've got the golem back in this one, too. At least Matt thinks about him. That's it. Got dice in Matt's head again.
Which happened to stop when...
Was that the last
which happened to stop, you know, and like... the last chapter or so, whenever it is that she marries him finally.
That wraps up chapter 25. And now we will, very predictably, go on to chapter 26, as if the world were fog. We start out with Tuan's point of view. And as they ride through the forest, Tuan and Felicia keep close to Matt so that she can hear his conversation with Talmadius. She failed to catch Matt's lie that he did not know the dragon reborn. Matt's was her first kiss. Aww. Talmadius left Estian in charge of Mirandi. He is the only noble who listened to Darien, a commoner. Talmadius brought Adorian, Raymond, and Carloman with him. They were all banner generals now. Talmadius and Darien are lieutenant generals. Tuan is intrigued by the red hand symbol, Matt's ring, and the fact that he remembers Hawkwing's face. Tuan is bemused by Matt's complexity and capabilities. Matt is concerned about the crossbow and riding, but Talmadius said he brought only men who could ride well. They also have the new crank that lets them fire 7 or 8 times a minute. A mechanic in Mirandi invented it and was taking it to the school in Camelin, but they got it anyway. Matt's friend Tamani cites Madoc Camadron in Fog and Steel. It is always better to kill your enemies far off than close at hand. Why, that's the truth. Gordoran and other Red Arms keep a watchful eye out. Tom and Aludra ride up near Tuan. She thinks that Tom is a spy, but she does not know who sent him to Ebudar, though she suspects Tarvalon. Tom tells her the chance encounter with Talmadius must be because Matt is Taverin, tied to the pattern, in the old tongue, like Arthur Hawkwing. She scoffs and thinks that's a myth. In about an hour, they reach the rest of the band. They have not seen any Rockan, but they are still cautious. Most of the Sanshans seem to be to the north or south. Talmani scouts have located most of their camps from the Malvid Narrows to their current location. The men, as Matt approaches the camp, sing two verses of Jack of the Shadows. The band has its own mapmaker now, Master Roydell. He has made detailed maps of eastern Altara to the Demona Mountains. Lopin serves them tea. Nerim is delighted to be back with Talmadius at last. Lyalwyn, Doman, Noel Charon, Oliver, Julin, Amothera, and Mistress Anon sit nearby. Matt has a reunion with Edorian, Raymond, and Carloman. They bow to Edesina, Jolene, and Teslin, and even Bethamon and Seda. This really myths Tuan. Master Roydell brings his maps out, and Matt begins to study the one with the Shanchen camps marked and begins planning a war. Tuan now thinks he is more a lion on the hillside than a buffoon, and she is beginning to understand how little she really knows him. We then switch to Perrin's point of view. It is a night with a fat crescent moon. Perrin rides stepper near the windmills in Aqueduct east of Malden. Tomorrow will be the 54th day since Fael was taken. Snowy Dawn confirms that the wolves will be ready in 2 days. Al and Sulin confirm that the windmills are still deserted. Perrin gives the word, and Mishima orders 6 carts to come forward. It took the woman and Almizar 2 days to deliver all the fork root, but they finally got it. They lift a lid off the aqueduct, and Shanchen soldiers, including Arata, start dumping in the fork root. Sionid arrives with Furin Taro and Rovir Kirkland, her warders. He does not like being separated from Missouri. They enter the aqueduct to get into the cistern and then go to the fortress to wait for Fael. Galena was not sure how late the Shaido stayed in the town. Elias, Talonvor, 20 Chafael, led by Salande Darangel, and 50 Two Rivers men, led by Ban Alcine, follow them into the cistern. Two Rivers men include Tod Alkar, Leif Torfin, Kenley Marin, Billy Adara, and Had Alora. The last minute, Gaul joins them so that he can be the first to reach Shead, though he does not care about Bane. Perrin heads down the hill while the Shanchen continue to unload the fork root. Perrin would like to go with them, but he does not trust Galen and Agonda to stick with the attack plan unless he's there to watch them. Perrin rides down to the bottom of the hill where Grady waits. He opens the gateway back to Perrin's camp. He will return the Shanchen to their camp when they are done. The two camps are far apart because Perrin wants to keep the Aes Sedai and Wise Ones far from the Sildam and Damani. He wants to keep Grady and Niald from getting too tired as well. Perrin's camp is near Brightan. There is a Rakan outside the camp, which means someone has arrived with a message. Inside Perrin's command tent are Berlin, Inura, Brianna, Vinny, Aram, Bauer, and Tylee. Aram leaves in a disgruntled fashion, probably from Asima's camp. The scouts found 7,000 white cloaks 50 miles from the Shanchen camp, heading north. Rumor says Pedro Nial died fighting Shanchen. His successor, Eamon Valda, swore fealty to the Empress. Over a month ago, Galad killed him and led this band in desertion. Balwer feels he owes a debt of gratitude to Balwer for killing him and Valda. The other piece of news is that two more bands of Shaido are approaching Malden from the southeast and southwest. They will be there in 3 days. Suddenly, reality seems to ripple as though the world were fog. It happens 3 times, but no one knows what it means. Perrin says Fael is all that matters. Then we switch to Fael's point of view. It is before noon, but Fael and Alejandra were already beaten because Savannah's bath was not hot enough. 20 more Guy Shine begged to swear fealty just to her just this morning. They want to attack the Aiel. Rowan is with her, and he wants to play a kissing game. Many of the Aiel are now drunk. Thelina approaches. She is wearing clothes again, and her hair is less than an inch long after being singed off with the One Power as a punishment. Rowan leaves, and Galena demands the binding rod. She is nearly broken from Thrava's treatment of her. After arguing and slapping each other, Galena says straight out that she will leave tomorrow and take Fael and her friends with her. Fael says the binder is hidden in the town and offers to go get it. Galena declines and tells her to take it tomorrow morning to a building marked with a red scarf at the south end of town. Fael believes her, not realizing it will be a trap. So yep. That's kind of a weird chapter. I think the most significant thing with the ripples in reality, that was kind of spooky.
Yeah, those were... Man, I do not want to get into TGS spoilers here, but I really want to discuss something based on these ripples. Anyway, instead of that, when Tom's talking about Matt's Tavern, and Tuon thinks that Tavernness or the existence of Tavern is nothing but a myth, and then immediately after that sentence, she sees a bird fly up and fly around that and fly away, and she believes, oh, that's my omen.
No, no. She's so superstitious, it's ridiculous, and yet she doesn't believe that Tavern exists.
Well, and here's the thing, though, is that their belief, it's been, how long? I mean, it can't have been more than, like, 300 years? Well, maybe a bit more. I don't know, how long has it been since Hawkwing ruled, and we had I guess his death was followed by the Hundred Year War, so it has to be longer than that, doesn't it?
Well, Andor's been around a long time, and it came up when the Hawkwing's Empire was, you know, maybe 1,000 years?
I don't know. 700 or 800 years? I guess.
No.
Still, I find it really odd that, you know, somehow in this time since the, Luther Pendrag went across the ocean, so many things just of the common belief. I mean, honestly, it's strange how everyone on the entire world subscribes to the same religion. But
if you can call it that.
Yeah. But still, the religion between those in Ranland and those in Shaunchen, it's the same basic religion, you know, the belief in the benign creator and the evil dark one, but they get so different from there. I mean, the people of Randland know about Trollocs, and the Trollocs are a really real threat, whereas the people of Shaunchen think they're something of a joke. The people of Shaunchen believe in all these strange portents and omens, whereas the people of Randland believe, again, that they're a joke or what have you. And instead, they believe in things like Tavern. They believe in the Elfin, and which Tuon believes to be simply children's stories meant to scare children. I mean, what the heck happened in Shaunchen that all these things, which are practically, which aren't quite common knowledge, but when you get to those who have studied. Actually, a little bit of, dare I say it, theology of the world. These are common beliefs amongst those who actually do more than just say quick prayers to the Creator every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, they don't believe in Trollocs and stuff because there were no Trollocs in Murdral in Shaunchen when they got there.
No, there were Grom and...
Yeah, weirder things than that.
Lopar and some... But still, you would think that stories of the mainland would have survived the trip over. I mean, did they consciously make an effort to forget? I mean, this is even more inexcusable than the Aes Sedai forgetting everything during the breaking.
I know. I don't understand it either. It's like there's some sort of a rolling neural brownout that goes over the entire lands that the book covers, that they just suddenly, some catastrophe happens and everybody wakes up with amnesia one day. It's, oh, okay.
It also makes me wonder how different Shara is. I mean, we already know that it's incredibly different. It's a it's even more of a matriarchal society than the main Ram land. But also, you know, they believe that fate causes their ruler to die every 7 years and their spouse becomes the ruler for the next 7 years till they die, and then their new spouse becomes the ruler for the next 7 years, et cetera, at all. But still, just it surprises me that the basis of the religion can be the same thing for everyone on the world, but the actual practice of that religion isn't. I mean,
I don't know. I don't know what to tell you on that one. Well, I think part of the reason for that is that there isn't really a formal religion. I mean, there aren't scriptures that they go to. There aren't books that they read that, you know, codify their religion. There aren't druids to run around and recite it. The closest thing they have to anything like that are the bards and the gleemen who go around, but they just recite the tales for entertainment. You know, the tales of past, present, and made up, whatever. So it makes sense that there would be a lot of deviation from one continent to another, because there is no formal religion. There is no codified book of religious beliefs and practices and knowledge. There's no formal church structure set up. It's all just, you know, well, good guys worship the light, and they don't even worship it, really. They just basically respect it. And bad guys go with the dark. I mean, it's very loose and informal, and I'm sure Robert Jordan probably wanted to keep it that way in order to avoid, you know, problems. He didn't intend for his book to be allegory on any current political situations or, you know, religions or anything. His religion is basically similar to, you know, Arthurian legend. It's very loosely based on a belief, in Arthur's case, Christianity, but very loosely. And it's just as heavily influenced by, you know, Celtic and Druidic legend and so forth and so on. So that's sort of the way people operate in the Wheel of Time. They just don't have any set beliefs in that respect. So, yeah, there's a lot of room for variation then. People change stuff all the time. It's not written down. It just happens. I mean, languages change, for goodness sake. I mean, probably less in the Wheel of Time world than in the real world. I mean, you go back even 300 years in England, and you're probably going to have a tough time understanding somebody. You've ever heard Chaucer in Middle English or whatever? That April with its sure sota, the truth of March of Paris of the Rota, and Bob at every bathe and Swiss liqueur, of which virtue engendered is the floor. I had to memorize all that. You can't understand that without a translator. You didn't know I spoke the old tongue, did you? Not really. Wow, that's cricket material. Yeah, I knew it was coming.
Actually, I had my thing on mute. I was trying to talk.
Sure you were.
as odd as it is, I actually have a running theory that a chunk of the Old Tongue is very loosely based on Middle English, particularly with the number of words that end in a Y-E or end in an E that would just be that natural, you know, trying to be like Suta, you know, that it's S-O-O-T-E. and for some reason I was looking through some stuff one day here a couple months ago now, I was just like, wow, you know, Suravya Nindo Manchima Tai Shiete. I mean, it's just like, oh, that's totally Middle English.
It actually reminds me a little more of Japanese, you know, especially things like Taishite and Ninto and story. It sounds a lot more like Japanese to me than Middle English. But
I can see a fusion in the languages. I mean, obviously, a lot of your fictional languages are taken from things that sounded good to the author, and therefore they're developed out. I mean, you consider the fact that some of Tolkien's languages are based on Finnish, and it just, you know, it's really interesting. But yeah,
unless
definitely.
You're a lifelong linguist, you cannot compete with the Tolkien language creation.
No, of course not.
No, I think he started the language before he even did the books, didn't he? Didn't he write the books?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did that.
I mean, it's interspaced. You kind of get from the notes that he was working on a number of different things, but the man was a philologist first and foremost. So, I mean, mm-hmm. his study was of language and its varied rules and other aspects.
Well, not only the language was very cool, but the writing, the alphabets, the writing was awesome. I mean, Tengwar and Kwenya, I mean, they're beautiful. It's really pretty. Anyway, want to hear some more Chaucer? I'll be here all week.
So we have, in this chapter, we also get the very beginning of the rescue of Fahil plan, where Perrin is actually kind of seen to just begin the commanding of what, you know, he has that urge to jump in and go down the chute in the freezing water, you know, himself. And, it's a measure that seeing how obsessed Perrin has been with getting Fahil back, and, you know, I can't necessarily say that I blame him, that he, you know, does manage to do what he needs to do. You know, he stays to the side. He's like, you know, well, you guys go in, you get her out. We'll be hitting from this point this time. And again, you know, it was kind of like that earlier scene where he goes to get the fork root in the first place. Is mm-hmm. You know, Perrin has been, and I am currently in the midst of a reread of Eye of the World, Perrin has always been set up as the more militaristic of the three boys. You know, he was, you know, all along the ways and various other things, Perrin is most often compared to the warder. You know, it's most often compared to Lon in that first book more than Matt or Rand, despite that, you know, Rand eventually develops more characteristics that are closer to Lon than anyone else. Down to their steely, icy gaze that is the gaze of death and blah, 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 blah.
and yet Matt's the one that wanted to know all about the battles and everything.
And Matt turns out to be, you know, a wonderful strategist and everything. But, you know, Perrin always has been, now that I'm looking back on the series, has always been kind of that one that is set up. I mean, when he appears in the dream realm one time with Lanfear, he's wearing a helmet in his reflection, like a military,
yeah,
almost a Romanesque style helmet, which of
shaped
course
in a lion, worked like a lion, yeah, which I thought was odd because it wasn't a wolf. It was worked in the fashion of a lion. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's good to see that even as these plans form for him to, you know, he's getting down to the wire. We know that by the end of the book, he's going to begin the assault to actually get his wife back, finally. And it's nice to see that he is calm and more rational about it than I can probably say he should have been.
Well, and even Banner General Ty Lee was impressed with his abilities, so it's not like he was just kind of getting by with it. He actually has a talent for it.
27 is what we're finishing up with.
Yeah.
Wow, you get the good chapter.
So we will finish this re-recording up with our discussion of chapter 27, A Plain Wooden Box. We begin with Rand's point of view. He's writing Tai-Dai Char with Min, Olivia, Kudzwani, Nynaeve, Bashir, and 81 Lancers, Nandara, and 24 other maidens. They're in northern Altara, just a few miles from the Andoran border. As such, they're about 150 leagues west of Camelin, so Elaine is somewhat faint in Rand's mind, but not quite as faint as Avienda, who's in the Ardomen. The manor where they are to meet Tuan is to their west. Rand is currently wearing the Crown of Swords, and he's carrying the Dragon Scepter, and in his mind, Luz Thurin calls him a fool for walking into such an obvious trap. Olivia has revealed that the Daughter of the Nine Moons is actually the title to the heir of the Imperial Throne, and Rand's a little miffed about that. There are also with them more than 25 Ashaman Aes Sedai and warders, including Loghain and various others. Rand wonders where Nynaeve has sent Lon, and he notes that Kudzwani and Nynaeve are wearing all of their Tarangriel jewelry. At noon, Rand, Loghain, Narishma, Donalo, Sandamir, Kudzwani, Nynaeve, and Min ride to Lady Deirdre's manor. Nynaeve and Kudzwani are holding Sedar, but they have it masked. The Ashaman are currently trying to figure out a way to duplicate Nacelle's weaves from earlier and detect a woman's channeling. Further up the road is the village of King's Crossing, where a bridge crosses the narrow river Rishal. At the manor house, they are greeted by six Soldam and six Demane, followed by a short, dark woman. Nynaeve detects that one of them is channeling. In all actuality, this is Semirog using the Mask of Mirrors to mimic Tuan. Rand wonders how one of the Shanshan has learned to invert weaves, not realizing, of course, that it is one of the Forsaken in their myths. Kudzwani says she can't identify who is channeling, but she can do something about it if she gets a little closer. As they approach, the image of Tuan flickers and fades, and at that moment, Rand and Luz Thurin both recognize Semirog and fight with each other to wrest hold of Sadin. While they're fighting, Semirog reacts and throws a fireball at Rand. Rand, in an attempt to protect himself and Min, throws up his left hand, and as a result, the fireball not only destroys Dragon Scepter, but also completely burns Rand's left hand off, knocking him to the ground. As Rand regains his senses, he sees that Semirog and the Shanshan have been captured. Gateways open up and Ashaman come pouring through. Aes Sedai, warders, and maidens arrive with Bashir and his men. One pair of Soldam and Demane are dead. Donalo Sandamir and Nirmishma are both injured. Nynaeve and Maurice heal them. Bashir sends Agan and Hamad to search the house and Matun to form the Lancers for a defense. Nynaeve comes to Rand and heals his hand up to a stump, but claims it as the best that she is able to do. She also senses that there is something wrong with his eyes as well. Rand then tells them about Semirog. Falendre, one of the Soldam, says that Semirog is Anas Dorje, the truth speaker for Tuan. Semirog tells them that Rand has gone completely insane and that he does have Luz Thurin in his head. Landfear confirmed that he knew things that only Luz Thurin could possibly have known. Semirog further claims that Grandel, being an expert in people hearing voices from past lives, had said that curing such an insanity was difficult even for her, and that all hope for Rand and or maintaining any amount of sanity at this point is next to nothing. Semirog, of course, in the Age of Legends, was known as the Lady of Pain. Everyone is stunned at the revelation that they've captured one of the Forsaken. Falendre swears that the Shanshan thought she was Tuan and had no knowledge at all that it was actually Anoth or Semirog who was leading them in these most recent pursuits. Giswane and Semirog try, of course, to outstare each other. When Hamad and Agan return from the house, they are carrying with them a plain wooden box. It contains 6 Adam and 5 copies of the Sad Bracelets, also known as the Male Adam. And Eve, of course, is furious that Aganin has failed to get rid of them, as she promised that she would do. Rand says to send the Sildam and Damane back to Ebudar with a message that the Dragon Reborn still wants to meet with the Daughter of the Nine Moons. From here, we shift to Matt's point of view. Matt and the band are preparing a trap for a nearby force of Shanshan soldiers. Matt's plan is to create havoc among the Shanshan forces in the northeast of Altara to draw their main army out of the Mulveen Gap so that he and the band can slip through into Murrindi. According to Tom and Julian, the next Shanshan target after Altara is Ilion. That army is to guard against attack from Murrindi and Andor. Captain Mandewin leads 2,000 of the band. Remian is attacking a supply camp. Aludra sends up 2 green nightflowers, a message that the Camp Rockin is heading west for help. Matt will intercept that help. Esslin is with Matt. He would have preferred Bethamon or Seta, but they might refuse to help him in a battle against the Shanshan. Leilwyn has refused him outright. Esslin, Julien, and Edesina try to interfere with his plans. Tuan has planned to call Julien Rosie, and Satel always seems to take Tuan's side in arguments lately in Matt's mind. Lonadrid spots Aludra's signal. Matt orders Vannon to ride out as a lookout. Mandewin orders Connell to get the crossbowmen in order. Master Roydell has all the Shanshan forces marked on his maps. The Shanshan avoid the Luggard Road until they reach the Mulvide Narrows and the Mulveen Gap beyond. At the road, Mandewin has Admar, Aemdal, Modwin, and Dongal arrange their men half on each side. Tomanus convinced the Lancers and the Nobles to wear dull colors for camouflage. Vannon returns with news that the Shanshan force is approaching. When they reach Matt's position, Teslin channels a ball of light above them, and the crossbowmen cut them down using their bolt cranks to reload before the Shanshan can react. Matt quickly has them move on to rejoin with Carloman and the rest. They plan to hit the Shanshan again before sunrise. There is a lot in this chapter, and I actually wanted to start not with Rand and his segment of it, but with this development with Matt and the use of the guerrilla tactics of luring in, ambushing, and getting away. And once again, it's just showing how much Matt has absorbed from the memories of all of the men, the dead men in his head. And I thought it was an amazing thing that they're now using, you know, these turn cranks to reload the crossbows faster, which allows just for, you know, a massive amount of ranged attack in a very, very short period of time. And I've always been kind of surprised at how quickly war is developing in the course of this series.
Yeah, and you know, it's really cool, and I can't remember if it's earlier or... No, it must be. It has to be later in the series. And so it's something that we'll get to later. But a chapter that we see from Ferret Coretti's point of view, where, you know, the Strontian commander who has to deal with all this pressure that's Matt's putting on them, he has it in his mind that there's armies in the tens of thousands. There's all sorts of these people out there attacking us, and we can't find them. They must haul off their dead, and they're hiding so well, or what have you. And you know, Matt, I don't know how many people he has, but it's not in the tens of thousands. He has quite a few. I mean, how many does he have with him here? He has, let's see. Well, Captain Mendevin leads 2,000 of the band, so he has more than that many. But he has a sizable force, but it's not this gigantic thing. He's just using it so well that and not letting his enemies get any information. And that's the critical part, is the way he's attacking is they can't get a good count on what they're up against. And so so it's as much mental warfare as anything else at this point.
What else is there?
Well, we
go ahead.
Well, we kind of get an interesting thing here from Semirog. Obviously, we know that the entity that is Rand and the entity that is Luz Theron are different things. I mean, they have to be, otherwise they can't be wrestling with each other for control of the one power. But, what the heck? Here Semirog comes out with, oh yes, he has a voice in his head, and it doesn't matter that it's real. In fact, that makes it even worse. I mean, what is this? And I don't think that that's even adequately answered in Gathering Storm. I mean, what is this thing in his head?
No, I mean, I don't know that there is an accurate answer for it. Because, you know, it's, I'm not exactly certain. Yeah, it's really weird. I have to wonder, you know, this sort of reveal thing, you know, how much of a stab it was just to try to make everybody a little more off balance. And, you know, why would you even bother telling your opponents this sort of information? Oh, he's got a real voice in his head. And, you know, that, of course, means that he's gone completely over the deep end. There's no coming back. By the way, you've captured me. I don't care.
Yeah, love the staring match between Cadswane and Semirog. That's always great. Not as great as the epic match of wills as we get later on, but it's still great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No,
so hard not to talk about these things.
It is interesting that we have... I mean, this scene is fairly straightforward, the Rand portion of the scene. I remember... The first time we recorded this, I think we had a rather lengthy discussion over Semirog being such a artist when it comes to causing pain and misery. Why a fireball? Why such a crude and, you know, knee-jerk reaction kind of response? When you'd think, you know, especially with her attitude after she's been captured, you know, why a fireball? I mean, why was it the first thing that sprung into her head? I mean, you know.
That really doesn't make sense.
I thought she'd just take him and try to capture him.
Well, it almost would make more sense if she had tried to travel away, honestly. I mean, maybe she... Well, no, she had to have been holding the power. She's channeling this mask onto herself. She had to have been holding the power there long enough to be able to travel away right now. And she's about to be discovered, and the first thing she does is attack him. What? Just a random fireball in his face.
Yeah. I mean, and then think how different everything would be if he hadn't gotten his hand up in time. She could have burned his head right off. And then where would we be in the series? The Darkling would be pissed at Semirog.
No, he wouldn't.
And, you know, the world would be doomed. Yeah.
Yeah, because the kill order is only effective on Matt and Perrin, not on Rand. Ooh.
Yeah. I just like...
Was she thinking? She wasn't thinking. That's the answer. She wasn't thinking.
Well, I mean, I can tell you why
she wasn't thinking, too.
Why?
There's two names for it. One of the names is Taverin. The other name is Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
Machina.
Yeah, I mean, there is a certain amount of Deus Ex Machina in there. The other thing, I mean, I can't imagine that she had to have been that startled by the Mask of Mirrors failing. I mean, she had enough time to be able to react and throw a fireball. You could have thought that there would have been like 100 other things that she could have done, particularly with as, you know, skilled as she had to have been able to be.
Here's the thing, though. She knew that the Mask of Mirrors was failing. That doesn't mean that anyone recognized her. I mean, how would she know that Rand would be able to recognize her, honestly?
Maybe
she could assume, I mean, based on the fact that she knows that Rand and Luz Theron are whatever the heck is going on. She knows that he has access to knowledge that Rand Althor shouldn't have that knowledge of.
Do you think she knew
irresponsibly.
Do you think she knew about Rand and Morden's link?
I don't think she did, actually. Yeah.
And I hate to bring it up, but I don't because of the prologue of Gathering Storm.
There is a note here that was provided by Encyclopedia Watt, which makes reference to the blurriness in Rand's vision. It says that it sounds like this is the beginning of the fulfillment of Perrin's wolf dream of Rand with the bandage covering his eyes. From The Shadow Rising, Chapter 53. And I can see that possibly being correct. Right at this moment, the only thing I can say from what's been written is that it appears that, you know, his retinas have just been flash burned. Exposure to an extremely intense light right in front of your eyes, and that can sometimes cause, you know, damage and temporary impairment of vision. So I guess I've always kind of assumed that if Rand was really going to have something that truly, truly affected his eyes, not that he needs to take any more bodily damage in this series, that it would actually happen later and it would be a little more profound than that. But at the same time, we've gotten into a discussion now in earlier podcasts about... Well, actually, I can't say that, can I? Because that podcast hasn't gotten out of it.
I don't know which one.
We haven't actually released the metaphorical blinding yet, have we?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead then.
I think that's in the Moraine, which will actually probably be out before this one, so we could probably talk about it if you want.
All right. I think that it was discussed in an earlier podcast that we recorded, and if it hasn't been released yet, I terribly apologize to the listeners for this and that. But yeah, with things that later happen, there is a strong indication that some of the prophecies and some of the dreams have been interpreted as being literal events when they might not always be, and that, you know, Rand's blindness might in a way be more metaphorical than reality based or based in the physical manifestations. So I don't know. I would only wonder at this point at how the blurring of Rand's vision impacts his channeling.
Yeah. I would have to say that the only argument for it being a physical limitation would be the foreshadowing of, you know, the fissure. You know, the fissure's always worked as a man with a bandage around his eyes, you know, dressed in rags, wounds similar to Rand's, and so forth and so on. So it's possible that that's coming into play, but it seems like, you know, the vision thing isn't serious enough to be a permanent thing. It doesn't even seem like it's impacted him even as much as Matt had from the, you know, one power flash burn that he got in the first book. But he was wearing a bandage around his eyes for weeks.
Yeah, that's
days, anyway.
That is true. That's an interesting observation. I hadn't thought of that before. In either world, when Matt had to wear the scarf for so long because of the, or was it Matt or Rand who was staring at the fork?
It was Matt, and Matt had to wear the scarf for quite a while.
Yeah.
But the difference was with Rand, it was just a fireball which impacted on his body. But with Matt was actually looking at the lightning that Rand called down without even meaning to.
Yeah.
I'm presuming that was a lot stronger, you know, flash burn than what Rand had.
Yeah, that's true, but still.
But at the same time, Rand has also had the actual impact and concussive damage that a fireball exploding in front of your face would have.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could see, in a way, Rand's injury, at least to his eyes, being both less and more severe than Matt with the lightning bolt.
Yeah. Well, can I just say I'm going to miss the dragon scepter? I mean, ever since he got it in, and I think it was Shadow Rising, wasn't it?
It might have been.
No, it had to have been Fires of Heaven.
Yeah. Okay.
Because the end of Shadow Rising was before they moved out for Carhean. So.
Yeah, and When he followed the snow and shot him.
Sad. The only memento he has from that trip, and now it's just gone, burned away. And we have the return of the sad bracelets. Obviously, there's suddenly more of them than there was when Nynaeve had bid farewell to Egonin as she sailed away from Amadithia. Honestly, this is one of the really annoying things about Shanchan culture is Egana knew that these things really, that the Friends of the Dark would do anything to get their hands on them, and yet because of the Shanchan culture that she had raised herself in, that she hadn't raised herself, I mean, she really didn't have a choice as to where she was born, but that she had been raised in, she, rather than getting rid of this potentially earth-ending weapon, she gives it to a higher up to curry favor. I'd be a bit miffed at her too.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. And particularly because everyone in Randland, like, their sense of honor is through the roof in almost every culture in this book. It's always different honor than your neighbors in the next country over or the next continent over. But, like, everybody in the series has some sort of, like, honor code that they tend to follow very, very strictly. And it's like, yeah, how did this happen then? You know, you promised Nynaeve that you were going to get rid of these things. And then, you know, I could kind of see, I mean, they did get pulled over, essentially, by the Shanshan Water Patrol. And it was like, oh, well, here, you can have it. And, yeah, I agree that it is kind of odd that you wouldn't have, you know, that she wouldn't have felt in the least bit honor-bound to be like, I said I was going to destroy it. Poop. Into the water.
Well, she wasn't the one that agreed to destroy it. It was Bail Doman. So I guess she figured, you know, it was okay for her to do what she needed to do to survive.
That's true. I could see that, too.
Well, I haven't
been a while
survived.
Since I read that particular section, so I'm not really remembering the specific terms. I just remember that the bracelets were supposed to be destroyed, and then, of course, they wind up in Tuan's hands.
No, she never gives them to Tuan.
Sure.
Johnny gives them straight to Suroth.
Yeah.
For some reason, I had thought that one of the, like, one pair of the bracelets had eventually made it into Tuan's hands. Maybe I'm thinking in that weird dream state where I imagine passages of the book happened that didn't actually ever get written.
I remember those dream states. They're fun.
Yeah,
when you're up till like 9 o'clock in the morning reading.
Mm-hmm.
Never sleeping the night before.
Well, for me, it's interesting because I get the passages that keep repeating themselves. I swear that there is a passage somewhere in book one or two in which Moraine says or retells the story about the beginning of her search for the Dragon Reborn, and she makes a statement to the effect of, on the day that we were to be raised to the Shawl, Giatara Morosa has a foretelling. And then, of course, contradicts herself, like, later in the book or later in the chapter by saying we were soon to be raised to the Shawl, which is what RJ actually wrote in New Spring, and, you know, it has always been alluded to otherwise. The thing is I can only find it about every sixth time I read through the series, and even though I always vow I'm always going to, like, mark down the exact page and be able to quote exactly where this weird piece of errata is, it never happens. And so I'm thoroughly convinced that I imagine it, and it's usually probably when I'm extremely tired and I just think I've read it.
And I'm just going through my read-through again, and I've been kicking myself because I'm now on halfway through The Dragon Reborn, and I said to myself, this time I'm going to take notes of the things that occur to me, if not mark them in the book or something like that, and I haven't done it once. And, of course, the minute I get on to the next book or something like that, I've forgotten what it was that I, some little revelation, I'm going, oh, I got to use this on the podcast, oh, my God, I'm gonna, and it's gone. It's just gone. I don't understand it.
Like those are always nice.
Like it was fog.
I think that will pretty much wrap up this segment of our ongoing Knife of Dreams recap. If you have any ideas, if you see anything we missed, if you have any crazy theories, thoughts, suggestions, comments, criticisms, critiques, pretty much anything in that, there's a number of ways you can get a hold of us. You can, of course, call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. We do read all the emails, and we try to answer them as quickly as possible. Usually one or at least one of us will answer it, sometimes more. And we're always glad to hear from you. You can also look at the website, dragonmount.com, our esteemed host at the podcast page. And after each podcast, there are comments posted for each episode. You can post there. Several of us look through those as often as we can and post replies and comments. Sometimes we get some really lively discussions going on, so you're always welcome to join us there.
Also, you can find both us and our host site, dragonmount.com, on Twitter and Facebook. We have a new Facebook page. We had been using a group before. Now we actually have a Facebook page, which we like better, that you can find at www.facebook.com/thefourthage, or you can find us at Twitter, which is twitter.com/fourthage, 4THAGE. Also, our MySpace page had kind of fallen into disrepair. Well, we have people actually who are kind of taking care of it now, making sure that that it gets updated every once in a while, and you can find that at myspace.com/fourthage. Yep. Also, our carrier pigeon service had to be discontinued. Apparently, it's illegal to enclose these pigeons and ship them through the U.S. Postal Service. They don't like it. I can't understand why. I guess it's a biohazard or something, the toxic waste. I don't know.
Yeah, we were going to look into owls, but they were just too messy, you know.
Yeah. Message beef is still appropriate.
Yeah, if you have the capability, you can open a gateway and shove a message through, but do try not to, you know, damage anybody or anything when you do it.
Mm-hmm.
A simple chime followed by a very simple 8x11 gateway.
Mm-hmm.
Will deliver the message quite nicely. Incidentally, I enjoy my message steak medium rare.
Yeah. All kidding aside, we do want to thank a lot of people for just everything they do to help us out with these recordings, with these. Obviously, we want to thank DragonMount.com, our illustrious host site, Jason Denzel and Jennifer Liang and Kevin Dean and all the others who helped to make the site just so wonderful and put up with all our technical crap that we need in order to do this. This new service that we're using to record, TalkShoe.com, it's free, which is great, and the services they offer and provide, we're so thankful for them. Also, especially in this episode, we want to thank Encyclopedia Watt. Their summaries that they created for all the chapters are what we based our own summaries on that we use for this episode and all the Knife of Dream recap episodes and all sorts of other information. Bob Klutz, I think that's his name, yeah.
Yeah, that's encyclopedia-watt.org, and they're an immense help to everybody who's interested in Wheel of Time, but in particular, we here at the podcast appreciate them greatly. Fantastic resource for everything about the Wheel of Time.
Yeah, Bob Klutz is, I think he's owner of that. I don't think he does all the work alone, but I could be wrong. Also, for the music that we have that you hear before and after each and every episode, we want to thank, and we had to go back a bit and look into this to see who it was that actually created this. We went back to some of the earlier episodes to find the name and how to get a hold of him. His name is Josh Needleman, is the artist that provided the music for us, and you can find his music on MySpace at myspace.com/Josh Needleman. That's J-O-S-H. N-E-E-D-L-E-M-A-N. And the song that we're actually using is called Floodgate, which you can find on his MySpace page. He also has his own website, which is joshneedleman.net.
Yep.
I think that's everybody.
That was some of our lost lore that we had to go back and find. So I believe
yep.
we had a didn't we have a contest? This was before I joined the show. There was a contest for So I'd like to do more contests. So if you guys have ideas for something like that, let us know. We'd be interested.
Actually, and I can tell you this in 100% confidence, in the next episode, there is going to be an announcement for a contest. And then finally, our last thank you. We want to thank all of our listeners.
That'll wrap up this episode. We are going to disappear now. So, anyway, this is Virginia saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And until next week, may you all find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian and Doman Shima, Aishite. We'll be right back.
the guardswomen bring are Mila and Lenny. God damn it.
There's nobody named Goddammit in this priest history.
The guardsmen bring Armilla, Nain, and Elenia before Elaine. God, not Elenia. Yes, they bring Lucerne's dead wife.
Oh, whomever gets this to edit it, make sure I get all these sound bites. I want them.
No, delete.
Everybody take a shot.
Ignore the frantic producer. Pay attention to the editor-in-chief.
The editor-in-chief could be demoted at any time.
But then the producer would have to take over the job.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Hey, the Dark One never has these problems. He can just fire people at will. Or balefire them.